This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This year, the country is celebrating the 100th anniversary of the creation of the National Park Service. VPR is also commemorating the occasion with a series of commentaries by UVM Professor of Environment and Natural Resources Robert Manning about the national park system. Here he shares a glimpse of what makes national parks special.
National parks are some of the last places we can experience natural darkness. However, like an increasing number of issues, managing natural darkness is inherently challenging because the National Park Service can't directly control light generated outside the parks. It must partner with neighboring communities. Acadia National Park is an exemplar, working with their gateway town of Bar Harbor to pass a progressive lighting ordinance. One of the best views in the national parks allows us to come face to face with the vast night sky and offers a comforting perspective on our place in the universe.
Well, today we are celebrating, sort of, another National Park anniversary. It was 80 years ago today when Vermonters effectively voted against establishing a Green Mountain National Park. This is a subject near and dear to environmental historian and Vermont writer Bruce Post, who joins us now. Bruce, what a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here. It's also another special day for me. It's my wife's birthday today, too, although she's not nearly close to 80.
Well, happy birthday to your wife, and we're glad that you could make it on such a special day. And I want to point out before we get started, just for people who are thinking, wait a minute, we have a national park. We do have the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park. And
yes,
what we're talking about today is something different. We also have a national forest. What we're thinking about is a park that would have been like Vermont's version of Yosemite or Yellowstone, or a park that was sort of that traditional idea of a national park. So, Bruce, I'd love for you to take us on a ride here. Pretend we're in a glider and suspend your disbelief and think that we could actually travel an updraft from Killington all the way up to Jay in this glider ride that we're taking. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go right over the top of the Green Mountains and imagine we're looking down on the Green Mountain Parkway. What would we be looking at?
I've closed my eyes.
Yes, you have.
try to imagine that. Well, I'd even start farther south.
Okay.
And fortunately, I've been in a glider in the Mad River Valley a couple of times. You'd see a road in southern Vermont, a narrow road, 30 feet wide, flanked by bridle trail and another hiking trail, that would get high up near Glastonbury Mountain and back down. And the reason it would be higher up too in the south is because it's a high plateau. At Killington, it would have been at its highest point at 3,600 feet, but still 600 below the summit. And then eventually, when it gets up to your neck of the woods, you live in Moncton?
I live in Moncton,
okay.
Yeah.
It would have gone to the west of the Green Mountain Range, to the west, western part of Lincoln, down near where Rocky Dale Garden Nursery is, up what is 116 through Starksboro. You'd see it go to the west of Camel's Hump through parts of Huntington and Richmond, up Snipe Ireland Road, up Flynn Hill to the west of Underhill Center. I've been up there to study the land. And eventually it would have been well below 2,000 feet going through this part of Vermont.
And this is the road we're talking
about.
This
is the road, the park, parkway. It's a term of art, and we could explore that. And then would have ended at about 3,000 feet in the saddle between Big Jay and Jay. And Jay is bigger than Big Jay. I don't know why it's called that way, with a terminal resort built to national park rustic standards. And that's what you would have seen.
And on the sides of the road, just preserved land, wilderness, wildlife?
Yeah, and it depends on where you are. For a good part of the route, the right-of-way would have been 1,000 feet, 500 on either side. But in many other places, it would have been expanded to encompass more land. As a matter of fact, it is possible, but who knows if it were probable, that as one of the originators of the idea, Colonel William Wilgus of Ascutney, planned, you could have expanded the park to between 5 miles wide and 15 miles wide from Massachusetts to Canada. It would have been 1 million acres and would have had it been expanded thusly, it would be the largest national park in the lower 48, twice the size of Great Smoky, which is about 500,000 acres.
Wow. We're talking today about what would have been the Green Mountain Parkway. It's obviously not there today, as anybody who lives in Vermont knows or travels in Vermont. But listeners, I'd love to know what you think about this idea and what you want to know about the history behind it. Who conceived of it? Why was this thought to be a good idea? And why did it ultimately fail? Our number, if you have a question or an observation, maybe this is something that you know about from your family lore. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Bruce Post, you just mentioned one of the people who had conceived of this idea, but how did it come to be an idea that was at least floated out there for a while that this would be a bright idea for Vermont?
Well, and part of the myth is that it was going to be imposed on us by the feds. Well, really, and I hear this about renewable energy once in a while, it was actually a homegrown idea. There was a group of 200 prominent Vermonters who in 1931 published something called Rural Vermont, a Program for the Future. And its Committee on Summer Tourists, which I think included Dorothy Canfield Fisher, was beginning to get sort of the first sense of an environmental sentiment in the state. And they called not only for a scenic road high up on the ridges of the Green Mountains, a rather radical idea for the time, that the federal government, the state government, and the universities should actually control the summits of the Green Mountains. So that was 1931, and Wilgus came out with his idea in 33. And Wilgus was an engineer. He was the designer of Grand Central Terminal. And his design had the road way up high, which led to a lot of opposition. But the map also shows it expanded to that large national park. But Wilgus, very early on, said to the leadership of the Green Mountain Club, which was largely centered in Rutland area, that, oh, no, this is just a preliminary sketch. We'll fly over it with airplanes and take pictures, and we'll consult with the Green Mountain Club. We don't want to interfere with the Long Trail. And then we'll bring in landscape architects to really do the planning. And eventually, in 1934, the National Park Service came in and began the what they call reconnaissance survey. And it was led by a guy named Laurie Cox, who graduated from Bellows Falls High School, although he was Canadian of birth, and he was 52, but he knew Vermont, and I think he loved Vermont. And so he then proceeded to walk the state for the next 8 months.
To walk the state.
He walked. Yeah. Well, they drove partway, too. You can see their survey truck on some of the pictures, but they had to be on boots on the ground, accompanied by the president of the Green Mountain Club, making certain that the road was tuned in a way, built to national park standards that are different than highway standards. So it would have a varieties of experience for drivers, for hikers, for horseback riders, and that it would not interfere with the Long Trail. And if it did, they would relocate the Long Trail at government expense.
All right, so this was all planned out and thought out, and the trail was mapped as it would have been. And in looking at trying to get public sentiment on their side, proponents of this idea said, well, this is going to create a lot of jobs for the state. This will be great. And
yes.
How many jobs did they think it was going to create?
Well, I don't know. But the federal government was going to provide $15 million. Now, I've done a little inflation adjustment using Bureau of Labor Statistics things, and it would be nearly $300 million today. But if for construction, who knows? And that's notable because I think the first time the federal government gave money for a national park was to the Great Smokies, and it was about $3.5 million. So there would have been money. And then the question of was maintenance going forward. But one thing you keep about is just not the jobs that were created building it, but what are the jobs that are sustained by a national park long term? And I think Bob Manning probably knows that pretty well.
So there were other ideas and other things that proponents of this idea thought would be great for the state. How did they promote this plan?
Well, there was a division of opinion, obviously. The Proctor family controlled the Green Mountain Club at the time. The Proctors were Vermont Marble. Mortimer Proctor in 1933 was president of the club. One of the vice presidents of Vermont Marble was on it, colleagues of his. And the Rutland Herald was their megaphone. And they sort of were a proxy for the Proctors. And they were very much against it. And initially they said it would destroy the Long Trail. Up north, it was a different story. James Taylor, the founder of the Green Mountain Club, was executive secretary of the Vermont State Chamber of Commerce. He believed it would be a great idea. Clarence Cowles, who is legendary in the Green Mountain Club, cut the first trails with Craig Burt. He was in favor of it. And Lois McClure's father, David Howe, was the publisher of the Burlington Free Press. And I don't think he was a new FDR guy, but he thought this was a great idea. So you had this battle back and forth in the newspapers, in the legislature, leaflets circulated around. So that's how it was debated.
And they thought it would bring great tourism to the state, be a great way to promote
the
state?
Well, the folks in the north did. And the folks that were the opponents were afraid of the tourists it would bring. There was a vituperative letter written by a guy named Roderick Olsendom, who was from originally from Woodstock, lived in New York City. He knew the Proctors. He also knew David Hall. He said, for every one desirable visitor, you're going to get 1,000 who are not so desirable. And he mentioned something which is sort of coded language, the tribes of the East. And you know the 12 tribes of Judah and of Israel. And Proctor talked about undesirables. And the thing that changed my perspective on the Parkway was a letter written by George Aiken, who was then lieutenant governor. When I first read about the Parkway in Frank Bryan's book, Yankee Politics in Rural Vermont, years ago, I thought, yeah, what a dumb idea. Okay? But I couldn't get it out of my mind. This would make a great movie about Vermont environmentalism and populism. But I was confused because how could James, and I was going to have James Taylor play the heavy, the villain, and this Arthur Wallace Peach, who was a professor at Norwich, where I went, would be the hero because he was fighting against it. But I said, how can Taylor be proclaimed as a villain? So I did more study, and I went back to Frank's book, and I found a curious statement by George Aiken, who said he couldn't get excited one way or another. And I'm on the State Library Board, so I called down there, and I said, could somebody try to find that article for me? Frank didn't footnote it, but it was in the Burlington Clipper. And I got it. And sure enough, he wrote this minister from Johnson, who was in favor of it, a progressive minister, and said, well, I don't think it's going to do the damage the opponents think. I don't think it's going to generate the jobs. But if I were from Lamoille County, I'd be in favor of it. I'm from Windham County, where hundreds of families have moved here from the Catskills of New York to buy up farms and second homes. And they are almost unanimously opposed because they feel it would bring the kind of person they came here to get away from, the class of person. Well, who is that? The Catskills are known as the Jewish Alps. And then you look at other things. It changed my perspective. And then I went back and reread some of Arthur Wallace Peach's stuff. And
You think there was a real vein of anti-Semitism?
Yes, there was.
In this whole idea of not wanting the Parkway because of who would come and be a tourist in Vermont.
Yes.
Or maybe, God forbid, stay.
Vermont did not have a very good reputation in the tourist business. Even in the 50s, there were inns in the Vermont that were still discriminating against people. One of my friends at Norwich, David Briggs, who runs the Hotel Coolidge, tells me about being up at the Lake Maury Inn with his father when it said, no Jews. So I think that was part of it. It wasn't the only reason. And Aiken evidently admitted that to Steve Terry, who was then his aide, and Steve wrote about it in this book on Phil Hoff in a chapter called Civil Rights in the White Estate, where evidently it was Aiken. Steve confirmed it, said it was a real and mostly unstated concern that it would bring Jewish resorts and Jews the way the parkways brought Jews north from New York to the Catskills.
Bruce, you also mentioned that this was part of a budding environmental movement in Vermont and in the country. How was this seen as part of that movement and part of preserving the Green Mountains?
Well, as I said, the Vermont Commission on Country Life that produced that book, Study Rural Vermont, began to see that people wanted to come here in greater numbers because the automobile was coming and roads. Vermont was starting to modernize its roads. So I thought, they said, well, geez, we shouldn't kill the goose that's going to lay the golden egg. But I still don't think we had a real environmental consciousness until the early 60s when Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. Hub Vogelman, who you may have heard of, the late great botanist from UVM who did so much great work on Camel's Hump, moved here in the mid-50s to start his job at UVM. And he said he was stunned by the amount of ignorance there was about our mountains. We knew a lot about agriculture, but not about the mountains. And it was in the 60s that the real ferment in Vermont got started for trying to save our mountains from destruction.
So this wasn't really about environmentalism, this Green Mountain Park.
No, I don't think so at all, because I don't think we... I mean, how can a national park be anti-environmental? I know that there are men largely, want to get their... Wallace Stegner, who lived up in Greensboro, called them men with itching fingers. They want to get their hands on public lands in order to exploit them. But the national parks particularly preserve ecological zones and the environment, not quite as stringently as does a national wilderness area. The national parks have programming and things so that people are involved with the park, but they are not, they don't support destruction. I don't think you could put up a wind turbine development in a national park, although you can in a national forest, because there are different philosophies behind the two.
We're talking today about this idea of the Green Mountain Parkway, a national park that would have been built in Vermont, running almost the length of the state, north and south, along the Green Mountains. It was an idea that was proposed. It went pretty far, and we're going to find out coming up why Vermonters basically voted against having this park, and why FDR still fought for a national park in Vermont even after that. Our number, if you'd like to join us, if you have a question for Bruce Post, or if you maybe have some stories, some myth-busting you'd like us to do, or stories from your family, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with environmental historian Bruce Post about a failed proposal for a national park that was planned for the spine of the Green Mountains. As the National Park Service celebrates its centennial this year, we're looking back at why this particular national park never made it. If you have a question about what you're hearing, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Did our forebears make the right decision, or would you have liked to see a road through the mountains and a wide tract of preserved land? Again, 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So, Bruce Post, as I understand it, this plan was actually approved. It was ready to go. Leaders in Montpelier supported it. So it did come to a vote for Vermont citizens 80 years ago today, but the vote was not, should we have a park or should we not have a park? So,
well, it was a strange construction for the referendum, but let me go back a little bit, too. The legislature, more support existed in the Senate than the House, but even in the House, it narrowly lost. But people forget this, and Frank Bryan brought this up at a presentation we were both at. This is before we were forced to reapportion in the 60s. So there was a town in southern Vermont called Glastonbury. It had 7 people. Then there was a town in northern Vermont called Burlington, which had, I think, in the 1930 census, 24,795. They both had the same number of representatives in the legislature, 1. And so there was a lot of the resistance in certain rural areas and some urban areas. So went back and forth. But finally, they compromised. Governor, I think it was Wilson, called a special session in September of 1935, and they passed an enabling statute with a catch. You might call it catch 22, perhaps. And it said that if you vote yes on this resolution to have the National Park and Parkway start authorization April 1st, 1936, then go ahead. But if you don't, the next date would be April 1st, 1940. And the interpretation was that if you voted no on the first date, that was it. And the legislature eventually repealed it, I think, in 1937.
Because this was a referendum. This is what went to the voters, was not, do you want the park? It was, should
we
start the park? And this was 1936, March 3rd, that the vote happened. And the referendum said, should we get going on this on April 1st? So, I mean, really, right away.
Yep.
Should we get going on this now? Yep. Or should we wait several years? And so, and that was interpreted.
Some people, I think, interpreted correctly. If you vote, it's like this vote in Burlington the other day on the bike path or whatever it is on North Avenue. It got a little confusing. But if you voted yes to get started in 1936, they would have got started. By voting no, you weren't necessarily voting for April 1st. You were just saying, let's not get started at all. Although some people wrote in, I've seen letters from people to Aiken and others saying, what is this? I'm confused. I don't know how many people were confused, but that was how the vote was structured.
And more Vermonters said, start it 4 years from now or never. And so it didn't go forward on April 1st.
I think the vote was about 46,000 no or 43,000 no and about 31,000 yes. It's said it was an enormous turnout. Well, yeah, it was in a way in terms of numbers, but I think that was the first year women could vote in a statewide referendum. So you had numbers
you had an
higher.
Increased number,
but the participation rate, the turnout was, I think, about 38.6%, whereas for the presidential race in a few months later, it was 78%. So there was a little bit more apathy about it.
Let's go to Chris, who's calling in from Chester as we have this conversation here about the Green Mountain Parkway. Hi, Chris. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks, Jane, for taking my call, and I really appreciate you bringing up this topic. I moved to Vermont a few years ago, and I'd lived in Virginia for about 10 or 12 years. And Shenandoah National Park was basically built around the Skyline Drive. And you can see the results today where many, many people just come out and drive along the parkway. They may get out of their car to use the restroom or take a drink of water. Most of them don't ever do any hiking or climbing or any kind of wilderness experience. And one of the results, of course, with all the traffic is that you used to be able to see the Washington Monument from Skyline Drive. That's about 100 miles away. And you never see the Washington Monument anymore from Skyline Drive because of the smog. And I just want to say that if this idea had gone through, Vermont would be a whole lot worse. And this notion that the Department of Interior and, I don't know, the federal government had back in the 30s and 40s that national parks should be built around, automotive transportation is just totally wrongheaded. And in fact, I believe that most people, if they want to see a national park, should park, and they'll either get a shuttle bus or something to a trailhead, and then they can hike. Because people today simply don't experience the wilderness, the woods, the mountains, the geology of this beautiful place we live in, the Appalachian Mountains area. And it's just amazing to me how few people even feel comfortable being out in the woods or with the pleasure and joy of being in a place of solitude and quiet and beauty and wild animals and so forth. And it's a growing problem because more and more young people don't even know what a forest is anymore.
Chris, I hear you, and I appreciate your perspective, and thanks for sharing it. And Chris, who says, this was good foresight not to have this parkway, not to have this road leading through the Green Mountains. Bruce Post, you're an environmental historian and a writer. I imagine you and Chris have a lot in common on this idea of the importance of wilderness and the importance of getting to know your natural surroundings and caring about them. But from what I understand of you, you and Chris differ on the idea of whether or not the Green Mountain Parkway should have been built.
Well, first of all, Chris is from Chester, which that's Windsor County, I think. That's the only town in Windsor County that voted for the parkway. And I used to work on Capitol Hill for many years. I used to go to Shenandoah National Park a lot. I would park my car, and I would hike, climbed Old Rag, which then was outside the boundaries. I did a lot of hiking. Part of the problem that you have in Washington, D.C. is not the Skyline Drive. It's just the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area has grown so tremendously, and a lot of that traffic generates low-level ozone, and that's what that smog is. But now let's look.
Yeah, and either way, Chris is saying we rely too much on the automobile. Whether
absolutely.
It's, you know, in Metro DC
absolutely.
In the park.
But let's look what happened here in Vermont. This Laurie Cox said if the parkway's not built, there's this tremendous civilization at the doors of Vermont. And if it remains in private hands, it will be ruined. That was his prophecy, and I think he was right. Let's take one example. Jay Peak would have been the terminus of the parkway. It would have been a national, well, they called it then a national wilderness park, but we don't think of that the same way today in terms of what a wilderness park is, but anywhere from 20,000 to 50,000 acres. There would have been no skiing. There would have been no water park. And I've been to Jay Peak. I've seen the water park. I didn't use it. I was there for a movie filming. And you can actually go to Jay Peak today and never go outside. You can walk underground from your hotel to a water park, which I feel has no purpose in our mountains. So in a way, it sounds counterintuitive, creating this national park might have saved our mountains, not ruined them.
But you can go out in Vermont on a lot of our mountains and experience wilderness. And, you know, you can not go outside somewhere else, too, sure. You know, I think there are certainly perspectives on the ski areas and ridgelines and what that's done and other ways that some of our mountains have been developed and you know, big debate now with wind, certainly.
Yes.
But you know, there are untrammeled places in Vermont that you can go for a hike and get
outside. You know, there's only one mountain of our major peaks that really is unspoiled, and that's Camel's Hump. And it's that way because some Vermonters, including Hub Vogelman and Shirley Strong, Bob Speer, who started the Audubon Society, fought to save it. In 1962, there was a ski area proposed for Camel's Hump, and the Forest and Parks Board said no. And then they wanted to put in high-altitude chalets, and they fought to save it. You know, it would have been in the national park that Roosevelt proposed, but eventually it was saved. Over the objections, I think, Perry Merrill, the state forester, called it just a bunch of rocks. He was not a wilderness advocate.
Clearly not. We got a note from John in Norwich who says, I never realized there was consideration of building a road through the greens. I have been over Skyline Drive and the Blue Ridge Parkway in Virginia, and it's a very beautiful drive. I imagine it would have looked similar to these two mountain roads with a Vermont perspective. That said, I'm so glad that our Green Mountains are not a national park and were left relatively undisturbed. And we got a note from David, in Jefferson. And David says, was unemployment in the Great Depression one of the main reasons for this proposed Green Mountain Park? FDR wanted to put men to work on a variety of natural resource projects with the CCC and WPA programs. This was a time of high unemployment and jobs were needed.
Well, that was part of it. I mean, it was, you know, counter-cyclical with the Depression. But FDR also had a pretty high conservation conscience. He worked closely, even before he was governor, with the New York State School of Forestry, where Laurie Cox was from, on his property at Hyde Park to promote its forest health. And so it was he certainly wanted to deal with the economy and unemployment. Make no mistake about that. CCC was part of that, WPA, and various other things.
CCC, the Civilian Conservation Board.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he also, and Works Progress Administration, he also, though, had a conservation ethic that I think was married these two, the immediacy of the Depression with this objective of promoting these natural gems.
You know, while we're talking about FDR, so the Green Mountain Parkway failed, as we know, in that referendum. But FDR wasn't done. He was still pushing for another park in Vermont. He came to Vermont. He surveyed the area. That obviously didn't happen either. But what was he really hoping for?
Well,
afterwards?
He came here in August 1st, 1936, saw the Waterbury Dam and Wrightsville Dam, and went to a flood control conference in Montpelier. He rode with Guy Bailey, the head of UVM, president of UVM, and Bailey later wrote him about, well, let's build a part of the parkway, make it a national park. He says, let's do a national park. And that eventually got some action consideration, but the war came. I would like to just talk a little bit about a presentation I'm making next Friday, March 11th at 7 at the Richmond Free Library, sponsored by the Green Mountain Club Burlington section. It's called Three Poems and a Parkway. And you might guess that at least one of the poems is called The Road Not Taken, which has been called one of the most well-known and poems in American history, and one that almost everybody gets wrong. I don't think the Green Mountain Parkway is nearly as well-known, but for those that know it, I think most people get it wrong.
Because you think it should be here. You wish
that. I think the national park would have been a great boon. Imagine America without Yellowstone, without Yosemite, without Acadia, without the Great Smokies. That would be a great loss, and I think it was a great loss for Vermont.
Bruce S. Post, thank you very much for telling us the Green Mountain Parkway. What a pleasure to think about this history, often forgotten history in Vermont.
There you go. Thank you very much.
We will put a link to that presentation Bruce is making on our website. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Coming up, the Community Justice Network of Vermont is celebrating 20 years of work, but how do we know if restorative justice programs are effective? We'll talk with the network's director next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The concept of restorative justice is that crime is not just a violation of law, but a disruption of a community and of relationships. And so the aim is to repair those relationships and, as a byproduct, maybe reduce recidivism. This year, the Community Justice Network of Vermont is celebrating 20 years of offering restorative justice programs. And we're joined now by Johannes Wielden, Executive Director of the Community Justice Network. Welcome to Vermont Edition. Nice to have you.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thanks for having me.
What does restorative justice look like in Vermont in practice?
Well, that's an interesting question. The Community Justice Network of Vermont represents 20 community justice centers who work statewide to provide restorative responses to crime and conflict in their communities. And while we've been doing this work for 20 years or so, what's really exciting is that many other agencies and individuals have become involved. So we have programs offering programs for court diversion to the Attorney General's Office, youth programs to the Department of Children and Families. We have specialized coursework offered through universities and colleges across Vermont, and a growing number of programs in middle and high schools, which we think is really important and really exciting.
So I mentioned that the aim here is to repair community relationships and frayed ties within a community when a crime is committed. And often that involves the work of people who might be considered victims or who have been affected by a crime and the person who committed that crime.
Right.
Can you give me an example? I mean, I know names are probably not something you can share, but tell me a story about how that works, how you get those groups together.
Well, I mean, there's a variety of ways in which cases come to community justice centers. This could be as basic as having a dispute with your neighbor and needing to have a mediation to a diversion program or being referred by a police officer, a court, a probation officer. It typically, victims are given opportunity to participate in the program, and that can look a number of different ways. It could be writing a letter. It could be coming face-to-face to confront the individual and through a trained or with the support of a trained facilitator, find a way to move forward. The most important piece of this is the recognition that for many people who suffer crime and conflict, what they need is an apology. And what they need is the recognition that someone understands the harm that was done to them and the consequences of that harm. And for restorative justice adherents and practitioners and advocates, the challenge with the traditional justice system is that we don't always find ways to give meaningful voice to victims and communities. And so community justice centers are trying to create opportunities for that. And we have some wonderful stories on our website, cjnvt.org. The Department of Corrections has a really nice website as well that tells some stories about individuals and what it means. I think the big takeaway, though, is ensuring that victims feel like they have a place where they can come, and ensuring that community members who want to get involved in the justice system and through community justice centers have a place to do it.
But that relies on the willingness of all these participants. And I'm curious what you do when, I assume when a perpetrator is not interested in being a part of this, you know, that's one thing. But also getting victims or people who've been affected by crime to say, yes, I'm willing to be a part of this, must be hard sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
So how do you, I mean, you have the same and you're saying this is good and many times it works and people feel good coming out of this process. But
right.
If you can't convince people to do that, there's no way to sort of make it work in the abstract without the participation of all of these different people.
Well, I mean, we certainly do restorative justice panels and restorative justice programs without the direct involvement of the victim. And of course, victims have choices to participate or not. And the Vermont model allows for community members to serve on restorative justice panels and to represent the victim and the community where victims aren't interested in participating. But I absolutely agree with you that far more needs to be done to reach out to victims and support them to come. And we have a number of programs in place. The Burlington Community Justice Center has a wonderful parallel justice program that involves victim outreach, and the Montpelier Community Justice Center has developed their own outreach program. I think what it is creating the expectation and understanding among victims that they will be supported and that a meaningful resolution can come out of it. And I think you're right that it's about telling stories and ensuring that people understand that process. In fact, Deborah Lee Luskin, who's not a stranger to VPR, has done some wonderful work breaking down some of those stories, and we've actually collected some of her work on our website that I think sort of get at it. But one of our priorities moving forward is to create new opportunities for CJCs to expand our work with and for victims. And there's no question that our members are committed to doing it. It's finding new ways to reach them, and that's... And that's a challenge, and it's a challenge that we are ready to take on.
Another challenge is actually proving the effectiveness of these programs, because again, with anecdotal evidence, you know, you can say, but look, this group of people say they feel better after this process, or this has actually repaired a rift. But when it comes to getting funding, when it comes to having support for your programs, you have to have sort of provables. And one of the ways that this is tracked is through recidivism.
Right.
And if offenders recommit crimes.
Right.
But I understand that's not really the goal of restorative justice. So how do you then marry these two ideas and track recidivism and try to make a case for why you think restorative justice is so worthy?
No, I mean, it's a great question, and I think the first place you look to is rigorous peer-reviewed research. And so the Campbell Collaborative, which is sort of the model of the Cochrane Collaborative, which is where evidence-based medicine first got its foothold, publishes systematic reviews that look at a variety of different RJ programs. In 2013, they did a study looking at 10 different research studies on three continents, and they were selected because they met very stringent inclusion criteria. 9 of those 10 were found to significantly decrease reoffending and increase victim satisfaction. So there is international research that suggests it's really valuable. Here in Vermont, the Crime Research Group recently presented results from their results first analysis to the legislature, and they concluded the RJ programs being delivered at community justice centers met the standard of evidence-based. which meant that they'd been through a rigorous process and found to have a meaningful impact.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're running out of time. But Johannes Wieldon, Executive Director of the Community Justice Network of Vermont, celebrating its 20th anniversary this year, I want to thank you for telling us today about restorative justice.
Thank you, Jane. And if listeners are interested, please come to our website, find your local community justice center, and get involved. We need all hands on deck. Thanks.
And we close today with music from our video series, Live from the Fort. Singer-songwriter Myra Flynn's new band, called Flynn, played a session in our performance studio recently. The video of that mini-concert is out this week at vpr.net. Myra Flynn splits her time between West Brookfield, Vermont, and Los Angeles, where she's working with a producer. She says, "Dichotomy is my thing," and she describes herself as half black and half Irish. She's a singer and a songwriter, and then there's the whole bicoastal lifestyle. Here's Flynn with the song Color Me Love, performed for VPR's Live from the Fort.
Flynn Show is kind of like an indie Motown show. You know, it's got the funky bass lines of a Motown beat, but then the lyrics are going to be kind of heavy, like a singer-songwriter. So you can expect to feel conflicted, but hopefully good.
I wore that dress just one time. I settled on a day to make you mine. If we cross that finish line, then we will be alright. Then we will be just fine. I try to date, no one understands my new perspective on a man. It's one thing I know now after watching you go, is that anyone can? Yeah, baby, anyone.
Describe my music is that I feel like at a certain point when I was a lot younger, everybody was trying to make me this like pop star, like this really sexy pop star, and I got so bummed out about it because I consider myself an intellectual. I'm a journalist, you know, so it was really difficult for me to figure out how to be that, and so I got, you know, defiant and became the opposite of that, and so I was like, I'm a very serious singer-songwriter, and now I'm kind of feeling like, all right, I'm able to maintain both. Somewhere along the line, I forgot to have fun. So this group, this new music, this year, this time, I'm trying to remember how to do that in my songwriting and to just kind of have a blast. So I think that this new music is just fun. I used to get really weird when people would dance to my music and be like, they're not listening. And now I'm like, yeah, I'm ready. Dance. I think it's a rocking good time.
I have to believe what I feel is still real. So call me crazy. You can call me crazy. And call me senseless. And call me stupid. And I still believe in love. You can call me crazy. And call me senseless. And call me foolish.
nice way to wrap up the show today. The Red Sox sold Babe Ruth to the Yankees in 1919. It's a legendary moment in the history and mythology of baseball. But sports historian Glenn Stout says we don't know the whole story, and he'll tell us the whole story tomorrow on the show. So send your questions and comments about Babe Ruth to VermontEdition@vpr.net and tune in at noon. Our producers are Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. We have production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Liam Connors directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm, and Flynn carries us out here with Color Me Love.
Stewart.